Today's episode of What's the Big Idea is brought to you by interconnectedness. Oh yeah. Now more than ever, understanding systems and how even the most disparate elements of global society are related and connected will help us take on the biggest challenges of the day. Schools, we've got to do more with systems and interdisciplinary learning so our students don't see the world as a series of disconnected silos. Interconnectedness, check it out. Now on to the show. Welcome to What's the Big Idea? I'm your host, Dan Carney. Historians will no doubt have a hell of a time unwinding 2020, because while every thread might look like just another piece of the coronavirus pandemic story, they're actually connected to something else, something deeper. Think what the pandemic crisis has highlighted just about education. Inequities, technology, the continued importance of unions, the meaning, or meaninglessness, of much of our curriculum. And each of those issues is connected elsewhere. Against this backdrop, I recently had the opportunity to chat with Nate Bowling, a high school history and government teacher, and someone who speaks with urgency and intellectual heft about our interconnected world. Nate spent over a decade in public schools in Washington State, where, in 2016, he was named the Teacher of the Year and was one of four finalists for National Teacher of the Year. He now works at an international school in Abu Dhabi. He's also the host of the excellent Nerd Farmer podcast, where he takes on national and global issues through the local lens of his home state. Man, I really enjoyed this chat. We touched on politics, policy, the value of liberal arts, America's place in the world, and how living outside the U.S. deepens your perspective. I started out by asking him where civics teachers even begin their conversations with students as the new year kicks off. One of the most common adages I hear in staff rooms and in PD sessions is every teacher is a language teacher. As teachers, I think we say that a lot, but I think all teachers are civics teachers. I think we as teachers have a huge role to play in modeling how to be a citizen in a democratic society. While most of us might be small C civics teachers, you are a capital C civics teacher, teaching AP government, among other things. As you're heading back into this school year after everything that's happened since March, how should civics teachers be approaching this new year? What do conversations with students look like?
I nod my head at your thought that we're all civics teachers. Before I get to like the question you're asking specifically, over the last 20 years of American education, there's been this shift towards STEM education, and like STEM education is important and has its place. But I think that we've overemphasized STEM education. And what we're seeing happen in the United States right now is a lack of civic education and a lack of like grounding in the humanities. I went to a small liberal arts college. And when I think about the education I got in the liberal arts, which included some philosophy, some sociology, some psychology, some economics, I ended up studying economics further on. I just think that civic mindedness history, like the average American is not data literate, is not civics literate, and is not historically literate. And that is really what is the cause of what we're seeing happen in society. Now, to your question in particular, for people who like don't know, I teach at the American Community School in Abu Dhabi, and 60% of my students are US citizens, but many of them have complicated histories like with America. So like I have students who are diplomat kids who've been overseas their entire life. I have kids who work in business, whose parents work in business, have been overseas their entire life. And I have people whose like parents are in the military or in the medical field, and it's their first time overseas. And so my students are all very aware of what's going on in the world. And I think that I'm gonna walk into school next week or in 2 weeks. And I think one of the first things I'm gonna say to students is, this is not normal. It's not normal to have the president of the United States deploying agents in unmarked vehicles to kidnap citizens from the streets. It's not normal for 1,000 people a day to be dying from a pandemic. It's not normal to cut taxes during a time of recession. It's not normal to have the president of the United States ignoring the Supreme Court. It's not normal to have people who are conspiracy theorists and QAnon basically taking root within one of the major party coalitions. Like, none of it's normal. And I think it's okay to say, kids, this is not normal.
On that point of normal, I agree with you. I was listening to an interview recently with a climate scientist, and he was talking about the idea that one of the hardest things about fighting climate change is that people tend to see normal as what they grew up with. You can give them statistics and figures from the past, but whatever they grew up with is sort of their window of normal. So what do we say to students who are coming into political consciousness in these last few years? Trump is kind of what they know. How do you frame that for them to help them see that that's not normal?
Well, so two things. When you talk about that, environmental studies, they call that generational change, right? And so for me, I see salmon runs, and I see that salmon runs are lower than they were like when I was a kid. But if my grandfather was alive and could see the salmon runs, the change that have happened in the salmon runs from my grandfather's time to now are where the real change happens. And like with environmental catastrophes, it's slow motion change. That generational change thing is real. To the point of helping kids get oriented to what's normal, I think that's where history really matters. And oftentimes, so the last 4 years teaching government has been interesting because essentially I've been teaching how it's supposed to work and then pausing and giving a moment of, now tell me how reality deviates from what we said. Like the world that you and I grew up in is basically a consensus that was built post-Watergate. Post-Watergate, we create electoral reforms. We create the Church Commission, which puts in reforms over like intelligence gathering. We basically have some political norms that are established. And what we're really seeing is that post-Watergate consensus is being deconstructed. At the same time, the economic argument, the economic arrangement of the United States post-World War II has been deconstructed over the last 40 years, like going like neoliberal economics and tax cuts, uber Alice under Reagan. And so it's hard to talk to a 16-year-old about what's normal when the Clinton administration is the 1990s in ancient history to them, right? So I'm old, like I'm 40, right? And I often think about how when I was a kid in the 90s, the 60s were only 30 years ago, right? So now for today's kids, the 90s were 30 years ago and the 60s were 60 years ago. And so it's a difficult conversation to have with students, but like you have to build context. And well, actually, I think one of the things that's helpful that I found last year was we read the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers and looked at the arguments that are being laid on the founding. And my students were like, none of that's how it's working right now. And I'm like, exactly. Right. And so we can talk about what was the, it's funny because people on the political right like to talk today about the founders and originalism and original intent. But the political right is leading us further and further away from the original intent of the founders when it comes to separation of power, checks and balances. And so I think the way to do that, the way to get them to understand that they're not living in normal, and also to not disempower them about that, because that's one of the things is, it's like, I don't preach pessimism, I preach activism, right? Like, I want my students to understand the world today is not normal, and then talk about how they can advocate. And so I think the way that's done, long story longer is to ground students in the founding period and ground students in recent history.
To a point that you brought up recently, the lack of political will we see in our country. And I'm thinking of this, the activist Greta Thunberg, climate change activist, she speaks a lot about cathedral thinking, the idea that you don't have to know how to build the roof. You can start laying the foundation now. And I wonder how you see kind of merging these ideas of we're stressing STEM in schools when a lot of the problems we're confronting, the solutions actually are already sitting in front of us. We just don't have the political will. And maybe because we're not emphasizing in education things like what you talked about, history and literature, psychology, oration, the types of things, persuasive writing, how we get people to take those ideas that already, those solutions that already exist and push them forward.
There's two different kind of threads there. So the obsession with STEM makes sense to me, I understand, because like I'm from the Seattle area, and in particular, the industries in Seattle are very tech-based. So like you have Boeing looking for engineers, you have Microsoft and all the other tech companies are basically there looking for software designers. And essentially they were banging the drum saying we needed more of those. And that's true, they needed more. And that's why they brought in people on visas because they didn't have them. Great, true. And I'm not an anti-STEM person, but I think that the focus on STEM has done students, the sole focus or seemingly sole focus or perception of sole focus or some sort of adjective of sole focus has devalued the humanities and devalued the liberal arts. And so for me, I think about why Steve Jobs and Apple works and like so many other companies don't. Like Steve Jobs understood the humanities. He understood aesthetics. Like one of his goals was to make devices that were elegant and that were easy to use. And like that is a teaching from the that comes from humanities and aesthetics. Android phones have been better than iPhones for 10 years on specs, but not on aesthetics and not on on use. And so to me, that's an example that like, if you only have STEM and don't have the humanities, you don't get as good of a product. Like I think about what is happening to our society and how we're seeing violent white supremacists and all sorts of other folks being radicalized by social media. You have these cats at YouTube who have no grounding in ethics and humanities and civics that only know how to code. And they're creating these algorithms that maximize the amount of time that kids spend on a screen. But like it does it by feeding them things that radicalize them. Like somebody who's grounded in ethics and has a sense of philosophy and a sense of like what society and the greater good isn't going to do that. I'm not actually answering your questions. Let's get to the answer to your question.
Sorry, my question was winding and confusing.
No. So I want to get to the answer now. So when we talk about political will, and this is a hammer that I like hit a lot about political will, the United States is the wealthiest country in human creation and has the capacity to provide students with the education they need and has the capacity to provide state-of-the-art infrastructure and chooses to do neither. And I just have always been an advocate about politics, and I've always said that all politicians yield to the appropriate amount of public pressure. Like Richard Nixon ends up being, in hindsight, one of the most progressive presidents of the post-war era because people were in the streets and he had no choice. And so out of the Nixon administration, you get the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the creation of HMOs, which for the time were progressive, and the creation of affirmative action. Like that's more progressive policy than Bill Clinton pushed through. But Nixon was dragged kicking and screaming through that by the people in the streets and by Congress. And one of the things that I think about is that I think a lot of activists and political activists have forgotten the importance of actually doing activism, right? Like so much of the discourse around climate change, around elections, around immigration is people who agree arguing about nuances within what they agree, instead of trying to convince people who need to be convinced in order to activate them for the fight. And I think that's where the work is. The other thing I'll say is that like the typical American doesn't know enough about what's happening in the world and happening elsewhere. I don't think the typical American understands how far out of the international consensus the United States is around climate change, or how far out of the international consensus and the work being done elsewhere the United States is in transferring to clean energy, or, you know, a pet issue of mine, how far out of the international consensus the United States is when it comes to state violence and the police. Like I've always said that, like, listen, the Black Lives Matter cases is that American police killed too damn many people, right? And if every time a American was killed by law enforcement and that American was unarmed, it was a national scandal, there wouldn't be protests. But so much of what's happening in the United States, people in the United States consider to be normal. Like climate denial is not normal worldwide. Imperialism is not normal worldwide. State violence is not normal worldwide. But if you only consume American media, you're normalized to believe those things are all normal. You're basically convinced of, if you consume American media, like you're conditioned to believe that half the population believes that climate change isn't real when it's not true. That half the population believes that state violence is against Black people at a systemic level is acceptable. That's not true, right? And one of the things that like I've been getting my head around in my own podcast is I knew a lot of journalists and talking to journalists about the way that they use neutrality is not actually informing people and helping the national discourse. Like, so provocative thought here, truth is more important than objectivity. And I'd rather a journalist tell me the truth than frame some objective, like one side says other, like constructed dichotomy.
Yeah, as teachers, that's been sort of one of the holy grails of being a social studies teacher, right? Objectivity, that you need to make sure you're presenting both sides. You're making an argument that maybe that's a wrong approach.
Yeah, there's not two sides to the Holocaust, right? There's not two sides to slavery. There's not two sides to Jim Crow. And so for me, so it's funny because I think people, because of my personal stances like online and in activism, think that my classroom is a more radical space than it is. I don't share what I think with my students very often. They'll often ask, well, Bolin, what do you think? It doesn't matter what I think. But at the same time, like, I make sure that I want to say this thoughtfully. I make sure that when I'm talking about the world, that I make sure that my students understand where I stand on certain philosophical issues, which to me are not political issues. So let me unpack that a little bit. Like, I am a unrepentant advocate for voting rights. I'm an unrepentant advocate for the protection of civil liberties. So like, those are two areas where like, I am uncompromising. Like, I believe in the power of checks and balances and believe in the Article I powers of Congress to check the presidency. So like, I don't talk about the fact that I donated to Elizabeth Warren and the fact that I donated to Jay Inslee, but I do talk and I do present the idea that like, I actually give a damn about voting rights. And I think students respect that more. Like, I can't imagine getting into this profession and doing this work with the idea that my goal is to remain neutral in front of people who are emerging intellectuals on the most important issues of our time. Like, that neutrality serves nobody.
And you said that engaging locally is the best remedy to tyranny. And it sounds like for you that engaging locally really starts in the classroom, in that space.
No, for sure, for sure. I have a podcast called The Nerd Farmer, and the origin of this show essentially was in my teaching philosophy about cultivating nerds. I used to live in East Tacoma and teach at Lincoln High School, which was like a 20-minute walk from home to school. And my philosophy and my vision there was that my students would become the future police officers, real estate agents, small business owners, entrepreneurs in the community, and that I was building nerds and building a better community. That spun out essentially with the rise of Donald Trump to a podcast where we talk a lot about local politics, because here's one thing that I don't think a lot of people think about. If you live where I'm from in Tacoma, Washington, and frankly, along most of the West Coast, your city council are predominantly Democrats. Your mayor is probably a Democrat. Your county executive is probably a Democrat. Your house member is probably a Democrat. Your senator is probably a Democrat. Your governor is probably a Democrat. And then you have Donald Trump. You're not going to change Donald Trump. Donald Trump doesn't give a damn about your advocacy, but you actually have the ability to influence local politicians. You have the ability to shape what happens at the school board on planning commissions. And so I've always emphasized to people they should engage locally. That changes a little bit when you go abroad, right? Because it's a different conversation, and I'm here in the UAE. But one of the things that I chose to do when I got here was be an advisor to the Human Rights Club. And the Human Rights Club here at my school does really awesome engagement work on human rights issues around the world. And like, that's my version of the same thing here.
I want to come back to your experience in the UAE shortly and just how that's shifted your perspective. But something you just said reminded me, with any luck, we'll get to talk comic books later. But the in the collected edition of V for Vendetta, the artist,
a classic, by the way, a classic.
Oh, unbelievable. More timely than ever. Every year it's more timely. The artist David Lloyd writes that V was written for people who don't switch off the news. That is, people who are engaged. And I'm hearing that engagement theme from you. But what about combating what you call our collective lack of attention span? How do you get people to not want to switch off the news when we're being bombarded with so many opportunities to be distracted?
So it's interesting because I believe in being civically informed and being active in the community, but I'm not sure that news as constructed in the United States is actually the avenue to deliver said, right? And I'm to the point now where like, I'm not going to watch the debates. Like, I'm not going to watch the convention speeches. Like, what am I going to learn about Donald John Trump between now and November? Like, I don't need any more of that.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more just maybe just civic engagement, because of course he was writing that in the 1980s when the idea of not switching off the news maybe was different. But to your point, yes, cable news and debates is not really an informative avenue right now.
Yeah, I think it's actually okay though to switch off the news sometimes, but I think you need to substitute that switching off the news with what, right? One of my favorite things to do is just to engage with people who I think disagree with me on policy, but are reasonable people, and just engage in them with in discourse and kind of figure out why they are where they are and try to move them. Like, when I think about American left politics, I think one of the biggest mistakes that I see happen is that socialists and progressives look at liberals oftentimes, well, let me say specifically, online, socialists and progressives look at liberals as their opponents rather than somebody who needs to be basically, or they should be nudging along the way to what they believe. And I just think that society in general needs more civic spaces where like slightly uncomfortable conversations happen between people who are reasonable, but like agreeable. And here's the thing is that like, what the internet does is the internet mainlines into your veins, basically like the worst possible version of everybody's argument. So if I go by the internet, every Republican is basically like a Proud Boy and every liberal progressive is, or socialist is like a Bernie bro who, like my friend calls it the dirtbag left. But like in the big scheme of things, there's lots of folks who aren't super plugged into the world and the politics who need like a nudge along, and that nudge along is gonna come through relationships and conversations. Like I was back in the States this summer and I ended up having a bunch of basically fireside chats with my father-in-law. My father-in-law is an evangelical pastor, lives in Shelton, Washington, a rural area. And we talked a lot about Black Lives Matter. And essentially, like I laid out to him my worldview that like, when I was a kid, if a police officer shot somebody in the back, it was an outrage. When I was a kid, if an officer shot somebody who was unarmed, it was an outrage. If I was a kid, when I was a kid, like all these norms that existed over the last 40 years have basically eroded and the police have become more aggressive, kill more people, more brutal in their tactics and are militarized. And at the end of the conversation, he's not like, you're right, but like, he's much further along. But like, that doesn't happen if we don't do that relational work. And I think that a lot of folks who are just hyper news consumers would be better served spending some of their time doing that work instead.
Can you talk a bit about what made you make the move overseas? And what have you learned about United States living outside it and students outside the United States?
My wife grew up as a missionary child in the Philippines. And I caught the travel bug after my first year of teaching. And basically every year of my entire teaching career for the first 13 years, every summer, I would spend between 4 and 6 weeks somewhere exploring the world. My first trip abroad was to Colombia. And I was in Cartagena in a majority Black neighborhood, seeing people who looked like me, like thinking my cousin speaking a totally different language and trying to engage with them really fascinated me. I visited probably 30 countries in that interval. And in doing so, essentially, I lived abroad for a year, but 1 month at a time. My wife and I, in the summer of 2018 or 19, a couple summers ago, we were in Southeast Asia. And I was with her on a bus, and we were basically going to a rural village to go to the beach in Thailand. And a bunch of kids got on the bus wearing hijabs and wearing like their English school suits. And I turned to my wife and I said, girl, I would teach the mess out of those kids. And I didn't say mess though, like you can guess what I said. A little later on in the trip, we were in Kuala Lumpur and I was like, I wanna live here. And so I am somebody who has been a teacher now, this fall will be my 15th year. I worked at a high school where I felt like I didn't have anything left to prove. And I'm somebody who wants to remain in the classroom. Like I don't wanna be a principal. I don't wanna be an instructional coach. I don't wanna be a consultant. Maybe one day I'll do teacher education, but not right now. I wanted to teach. But the work of teaching in the school that I was at was unsustainable. And so I basically married my, I'm not sure how much longer I can do this work at this level with this demand and love of travel to go abroad. I picked a school, not a country. And I came here expecting to like tolerate the country and enjoy the school. And I'm finding actually that I really, really enjoy the country and love the school.
I feel like international schools in some way are still the best kept secret in education.
Facts.
Incredible. So taught for 7 years, a couple hours from where you are now in Oman, and felt the same way. Went over there pretty unsure about, went for the school, pretty unsure about the country, wound up absolutely loving it. What's your experience been like in the UAE? Maybe talk a bit about the UAE. Listener probably is maybe seeing some pictures of Dubai, but yeah. What's it like there?
So the United Arab Emirates is a fascinating place. It's a place that I would describe as being incredibly aspirational. The country was only established like 48 years ago. There are seven emirates, and the emirates you know about are, and by the way, Emirates is kingdom, or like, yeah, kingdom's fine. The Emirates, you know about, are Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And so I'm here in Abu Dhabi, which is the capital. Dubai is like the Las Vegas slash LA slash Miami. And Abu Dhabi is more like the Chicago, Washington, DC. I love it here, man. Like, one of the things that I realized with my wife a long time ago, and I blogged about it before, is that it's only when I'm outside of the United States that I get the full benefit of being an American. Like, I'm a Black American who has lived, whose parents, so I'm a Black guy. My mother's from El Dorado, Arkansas. My father's from Laurel, Mississippi. My father was born basically to sharecropper parents. My mom was born in 1940 and like lived through the Civil Rights Movement. My parents both exited the South and moved to Washington State in the 1960s in order for a better life. And what we're seeing increasingly is that Black Americans in particular are leaving the United States for the same thing. I am shocked, or was shocked when I arrived here, at how many other Black Americans are here. There's an exodus of Black teachers that is happening from urban schools in the United States because the work as constructed is not sustainable. And a lot more of them than I realize are showing up abroad. And something I can say is that, like, there's an interesting thing that I'm sure we'll get into about nationality here and kind of hierarchy. But like, it basically works like this. The people who work in the service industry tend to be Filipinos. The people who drive taxis tend to be either South Asian or East African. The people who work in the medical field kind of come from all over the world because like doctors are everywhere. And then they bring in Americans and Canadians to teach. But what that means is that, or my experience here has been, is that I'm not treated as Black here, I'm treated as American here. And so essentially, like, this is gonna sound stupid and weird, but like, I get all the benefits of whiteness in the United States only when I'm elsewhere. And so essentially, like, and I had this experience in China, like my wife and I were walking one day and this kid walks up, goes, Lao Wai, and points to us both. And Lao Wai is foreign devil, not Black devil, not white devil, but foreign devil. So when I'm outside of the United States, I get the benefit of full Americanness that I don't get in the United States.
And I'm so glad you addressed that. I wanted to ask that because growing up as a white American, realizing my privilege in American society is work I've had to do. It's so baked into my upbringing, into life here, that recognizing my own privilege has been something that I've had to consciously work at. Living in the Middle East, it is just apparent from the moment you step foot there. Right. It's incredible. And I was very curious as a Black American if that, how that translated. And it's interesting to hear that it's the same. And the hierarchy is so fascinating. As you said, you have the laborers and the service industry, but then as an American, you are given all these privileges, but the host country nationals, when push comes to shove, are not afraid to let you know that you are a guest in their country.
Yeah. Well, and I am a guest in their country, right? Mm-hmm. And so like my principal knew what she was getting when she got me. And she essentially told me that like, you should not criticize the state and should not criticize the faith, but you should feel welcome to basically engage politically as much as you want to in American domestic politics. And I was like, fine. I have a lifestyle here in which I feel like I am treated as a full member of society with all the reasonable benefits one expects within society and with the protection of the state from acts of random unwanted violence. And I don't have that same feeling when I'm home in the United States. Hmm. And that's really the brass tacks about what it's like to be here. And I'll add that at my school that I work, the American Community School, there are more Black Americans working than working at any other school that I've worked at. So I'm not the only one who perceives that.
One interesting aspect of living in Oman, and I'll present my case. I don't want to get you in trouble here. I ask you to say something, but I was so teaching high school social studies, civics, diploma program, talking about the rise of dictatorships, fascism, etc. All the while living in a country not regarded by anyone as free. You know, I found living in Oman, you could go days, weeks, months, and forget that you were essentially living in a tightly controlled dictatorship. You know, a benevolent one, But there definitely was some tightrope walking at certain points in the curriculum, because if you really scratch the surface in that country, you'll find a lot of the same systemic controls that you had in those historic cases we were studying. I wonder, how are you sort of bringing in host country along with what you're teaching, all the while as an American, probably talking a lot about America?
One of the things I think that is important to bring up in this conversation when thinking about the United States of America is that America bills itself as like the world's first and longest running democracy. And it's true, the American Constitution goes back to 1787, like uninterrupted period. But if you're Black, it has not been a democracy for that long. And so if you're Black in the South, you've only been free for like 50 years. That context matters. When we talk about the government here, nobody has blinders on that it's not a monarchy. We understand that it's a monarchy, but as you said in the question, it strikes me as a benevolent monarchy. It's a monarchy that has universal healthcare. It's a monarchy that has universal basic income for its own citizens. And it's a monarchy that has an element of religious tolerance where like I go to church every Friday, not Sunday, but Friday here, mm-hmm. and I'm able to worship as I want to. Now, do I get a vote? Nope. Do I have a say in government? Nope. But it's not my country. It's interesting because I think a lot of folks lump the Gulf states together. And like, I think people think that if by living here in UAE, I'm living in Saudi Arabia. I don't live in Saudi Arabia. So like when I want to talk about authoritarian governments and authoritarian states, like I have those conversations in class, and my speech here is not nearly as limited as I think some folks may think. And honestly, if I'm looking for an example of an authoritarian state, there's lots of examples to use. Like you can argue that the United States is increasingly authoritarian. Like I have not felt that tension as much as you might think. What I'm going to do is I'm going to throw the United States into a lot of the class and throw the UAE into the class. But like, students know the score. I think that's the thing. That's the thing is like students know the score. Like they know, yeah. My students here know what kind of state this is. They know its flaws. They know like things that they'd like to change. And they also though are very aware of what the United States is. And so maybe adults actually might worry about this more than the kids do. But I feel like we have pretty open and honest conversations. And honestly, I imagine if I ever wanted to take a shot at the local government, I would just say it about Qatar instead. Because you can always talk about the Qataris.
Yeah, that's right. You can always use a proxy in the neighborhood. Yeah, right. one of my favorite resources when having these conversations about government systems is Freedom House and their mm-hmm. rankings. And throw that map up in front of my students, and there always be that moment. I kind of hold my breath for the local students in Oman when they look at the map and their country is in that dark purple, and then they hover the mouse over and they see the score, you know, but then of course they'll just look at UAE or like you said, like Bahrain and kind of gloss over that. But then what they do is then they look at the US and they say, mm-hmm. wait, the US gets a 85 and Canada's like a 99 and Sweden's 100. And they start processing. How is that possible? Because they've internalized the idea that the US is the benchmark for rights and freedoms. And that's an eye-opening experience for them. And I wonder, you're good.
If I may, one of the things that I feel when I'm here is that this is an aspirational state that is on the way to being better than it is. It's on its way to having a more open press. It's on its way to having more human rights and better worker protections. I don't feel that way about the United States. I don't look at the US and look at the current state of affairs and say that the US's best days are ahead of it. Before I left, I had a lot of conversations with people where, and I called it the Singapore question. Are you better off living in an anti-democratic or authoritarian state that is well-run and you are safe, or a democracy that is poorly run and you are unsafe? Because that's the paradox that low-income and people of color face essentially in the United States. Like we're being told that everywhere else in the world is awful, but actually a lot of folks would be better off in other places. Like Singapore fascinates me. Essentially like what Singapore did is, well, hold on. There's some bargains we make in American society that we haven't interrogated that are stupid. And one of those bargains is tying your healthcare to your employment. In other countries, they tie housing to your employment. Well, Singapore went one step further, and they've tied citizenship to, housing to citizenship. So the majority of Singaporeans live in publicly provided housing. And because they live in public housing, the government has used that to desegregate, right? And so is a kid who is 19 years old and thinking about their life options better off living in a state that appears to me to be in decline, or a state that is aspirational and moving towards, if not democracy, moving towards something that's more a liberalization, essentially? Like we oftentimes use modernity, democracy, and liberalism as like synonyms. Those are different terms. So essentially, I live in a state that is increasingly liberal, that is not increasingly democratic necessarily, but is increasingly modern. Conversely, the United States is democratic nominally. I would argue there's a rise of illiberalism, and modernization of America isn't happening. Like, the greatest acts of infrastructure of my lifetime are sports stadiums. Like, everything around us infrastructure-wise, the power grid, our dams, are like, can you imagine the Trump administration right now trying to build the Hoover Dam if it wasn't there? Or can you imagine like the New York government trying to dig the subway right now? Like, of course not. Like we can't do big things in the US anymore, and elsewhere you can.
Infrastructure has been, it's one of those, it gets floated every few years as a bipartisan. Yeah. Well, we can come together on infrastructure, but we never do. Is it lack of will, or is it lack of attention span, or what is the answer?
I think it goes back to the beginning of the conversation that like, there's a disconnect. It's a lack of civic literacy, essentially. There's a disconnect in the American public's hands between taxation and government action. Like, people do not contemplate the idea that the taxes that we pay go in order to fund government works and government projects. And so we've lived through a period, so I'm 40, I was born in 79, where essentially like every year of my life, the leading agenda item for one of the major political parties has been tax cuts. And if you just constantly do tax cuts and disinvestment, you get two things. One, the government does not have the capacity to make the investments it needs to build things. And then two, because the government is feckless, people don't believe in government anymore. Hmm. And that's what we're seeing in the States. Like, if you have a big infrastructure project, everybody in the States sees it as a boondoggle that's going to be inefficient because they don't believe in government anymore. And that's something that I can say that like my experience here is that people believe in government. Like, and there's data to back it up. Like, one of the data points that's in my head constantly that I share whenever I can is that the UAE is a population of 10 million people, which means it's more or less Washington State, which is 7 million, more or less New York City, which is 8 million? Yeah. Washington State's had, I want to say, 2,300 deaths from the coronavirus. New York had 23,000 deaths from the coronavirus. And the United Arab Emirates, because of the way they handle the virus, has had fewer than 400. And they're very public with this data. Like, they've handled the virus basically as well as any nation. And it's a point of pride for the people here. And so when the government says we're going to build some stuff, like, they tend to build stuff and people are happy about it. And I don't know, man, like, it may not be for this show, but there's a conversation to be had about the idea that essentially conservatism and libertarianism are not actual governing philosophies, they're critiques. But conservatives and libertarians have convinced themselves that they're actually governing philosophies. But like, what in the hell happens if you elect a libertarian to be insurance commissioner in a state? What happens if you elect a libertarian to be public lands commissioner? Like, if you think about the origins of American modern conservatism, like, it goes back to William F. Buckley being critical of the civil rights movement. And William F. Buckley cites Edmund Burke, who was critical of the French Revolution. Like, at its core, like, conservatism is a critique, not an actual like governing philosophy. Like, what's the conservative stance on infrastructure? What's the conservative stance on like, just that's something that's present in American culture that I think hasn't been unpacked yet.
Well, it's privatization. Isn't that the...
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. So the stance is that the state actually can't do things that the state's supposed to do. And so if you believe the state can't do things, the state won't do things.
Yeah. We just had a little problem here with the coronavirus data tracking in California, which to my eyes, California's done a pretty good job of tracking the data and making it public. But even this few-day window where there was a backlog of information, you saw people on the right just attacking the idea that the state could provide that information to citizens. Right. And, you know, months of hard fought efforts and transparency were a lot of it was rolled back just in a few days because a lot of people want to believe that the state just can't do it or shouldn't be doing it. And it's disheartening. And it's the kind of mentality I worry about bleeding into the classroom where students are going to come in already with a cynicism about what government can do because of episodes like that.
My faith in government is strong, but my adherence to any like particular philosophy is not. And I think that allows me to be nimble in the classroom. Like essentially what I want to do is I want to endow my students with a sense of skepticism. And I want them to be skeptical about systems. I want them to be skeptical about the state, skeptical about corporations, and also skeptical about me. Like, I don't know everything, and I'm wrong about stuff sometimes. And so I actually encourage my students to push me and to question me, and they usually take me up on that. It's really enjoyable when they do.
That kind of humility and vulnerability is so important in teaching. The idea that we know everything, that we are the ultimate gatekeeper in the classroom is such a dangerous mentality. And I've found some of the best moments are when you don't know something and yep. the students come to that realization together and they see you a different way. They see their learning a different way.
Yeah. I'm like, grab the laptop. I don't know. Look it up. Right. Uh-huh. Well, and here's the thing is that like the typical teacher who enters the profession is 50-50 going to be gone in 5 years. I was not the teacher I am now when I started teaching. I'm in my 15th year. And so that vulnerability that I'm talking about there and that humility in the classroom, and it's funny to say humility and interview myself, but whatever, that humility in the classroom is a result of like practice and having my reps. Students across the United States are being deprived of the opportunity to have expert teachers who have that amount of competence and skill because our schools are a burnout factory. Like, longevity is not a proxy for quality, but I'm better now than I was then. But in particular in low-income schools, it's a revolving door of newbies. And so our neediest students are getting our least experienced teachers, and that doesn't serve anybody in the long run.
More with Nate Bowling in just a sec, but I want to take this opportunity to shout out a couple of other podcasts. One I've already mentioned, Nate's Nerd Farmer Pod, where he recently examined COVID's impact on sports, college admissions, and agricultural workers. It's a very smart show. Also, be sure to check out High Tech High Unboxed, a beautifully produced podcast. Their recent episodes about having hard conversations with students are a must listen. All right, now back to my conversation with Nate. Most recent episode of your podcast, you or one of your guests made the point, imagine if we had put as much effort and money and time into getting schools prepared to come back as we have sports. Yep. And once again, education is short shrifted. It's on, you know, it's on the losing end of the latest crisis.
So I'm not one to drop Joe Biden quotes, but like Joe Biden says that budgets are moral documents. Even in places where school spending and education spending is going up, looking at where it's going up shows what you value. Like, okay, one of the memes that conservatives like to throw out is how much the United States spends on education. But there's two factors in there that need to be talked about that cause that distortion in the data. One is busing. Like, America is just so vast and like not dense that more kids catch buses to school in America than anywhere else. So all that transportation money is cooked into the budget. The other thing is that every other industrialized country has universal healthcare. And so a huge chunk of school budgets are healthcare for teachers, for librarians, for principals, for support staff. If you take out spending on transportation and take out spending on healthcare, all of a sudden what we spend on education in the United States looks very, very small. Hmm. But we don't do that. We just say, well, look at American schools. They spend more than Finland does. Well, like, yeah, they spend more than Finland does because Finland has a population, a homogeneous population for the most part, of students who are not living in poverty, who are monolingual, who live in communities that are fairly dense and don't have to move them to and fro, and the schools aren't expending money meeting students' basic life needs. Like, so many arguments that get made about education don't stand up to any interrogation whatsoever. And so, like, this whole thing with, like, reopening, we saw that school in Georgia where, like, they took a picture of the hallways. 300 kids from that school are in quarantine. Mm-hmm. Who could have seen that coming? Anybody who would have thought for 5 damn seconds. But, like, we don't value education, so we don't have these conversations. Something I think about a lot is that, like, educators care about education and talk about education, but I think that actually fools us into thinking that other folks care about it too. Look at how little education came up in the Democratic primary debates compared to healthcare, compared to the environment, climate change, global warming. And I'm not saying education is more important than those things, but it's as important as one of those things. One of my favorite podcasts, Radio Open Source, it's done at a Brown University. I've been listening to it since like 2006. It's like the world's first podcast, basically. I think they've done 2 episodes about K-12 education in a 15-year run. Like, we pay lip service to schools, but we don't actually care about schools, and it manifests itself in the way that, like, we're seeing the corona response in schools. And if I'm keeping it 100, if we don't care about education that much in the United States, we really don't care about the education of low-income and Black students, right? So, like, we don't actually care about education, and we care even less about the education of kids who we don't see as our own.
I feel like people care very passionately about their school,
yep,
their kids' school.
Yep.
Why not? Why don't we expand that same level of enthusiasm beyond our own schools?
There's a crippling lack of empathy in American culture that I think is manifesting itself in our politics and our culture right now. Like, people don't empathize with other people's children or other communities. And also, I think that relationship I mentioned earlier on between taxation and government services, I don't think... So when it comes to school spending, basically Americans pull a lever for a levy, or they call it millage in the eastern part of the United States, like every couple of years for funding. But beyond that, I don't think that people see a connection between... I don't think that many people see a connection between government and school, even in public schools. Like, and that sounds weird, but, like, I think that people think about their school as their school, and not that that school is a apparatus that is created as a service by government, and that government needs resources to invest in that.
How do you see the funding of schools being part of the problem?
So, there is a lot of research that tells us essentially whenever you see a school district boundary, that is one community saying to another community, we don't want your kids here. And the fact is every state does it differently. So, like, I didn't know until fairly recently that Hawaii is basically one giant district. Like, every school in Hawaii is one district. In other places, it's by county line. In other places, the lines are really, really mysterious. So you have, like, a township that, like, belongs to a school district, but the other part of the township does not. And so, like, there's a million different answers for that. Essentially, the long or short version of the story is that a lot of folks want to spend their communal resources on people that look or they perceive to be like them and don't want to spend those same resources on kids they don't think are like them or perceive to be like them. And this manifests itself where you have kids who, like, if you live on 84th Street, you go to one school. If you live on 96th, you go to another school. And like you said, the resources that are available, the program offerings are disparate. Like, I mentioned earlier on that I don't think America's best days are ahead of it. The Trump administration, the Trump rhetoric with, like, MAGA, harkens back to the 1950s and arguably the 1930s as being, and we'll go with the 50s, as being, like, the greatest period in American history we need to return to. And I can't see a period of pre-civil rights as being the greatest period of anything. I'm going to argue that actually the greatest period of the United States is the period basically, like, in between the end of the civil rights movement and the beginning of the Reagan administration, when civil rights basically in progress stopped. Nicole Hannah Jones is probably one of my favorite writers of this time, of our time. And she writes about how essentially 1987 was the peak year of school integration in the United States. And 1987 was also the year that the achievement gap between Black and white children in American schools was at its lowest. we basically have resegregated our schools. And along with resegregation has come resource hoarding and a widening of the achievement gap. Like, we basically danced up to the line of civil rights, and civil rights was introduced and basically pushed through by a federal authority. And when the pressure from the civil rights movement went away, and when Reagan became elected, we allowed local municipalities to basically dismantle the gains of the civil rights movement. And I think that reached its apex in the Supreme Court case Shelby versus Holder, where we basically said that, like, we're going to nuke the Voting Rights Act as well. Mm-hmm. Like, one grim interpretation of America today is that we're walking back the gains of the civil rights movement, the gains of the New Deal, and the gains of the Enlightenment.
What's it going to take for white Americans to know what you just said? You brought up Nicole Hannah Jones. She's written several pieces recently that I felt like provide exactly the historical context that so many white Americans need. Do you feel like white people in America, but maybe more importantly, white educators have reached a point where they're willing to do that?
I think you and I overestimate the percentage of people in our profession and the percentage of people in the US kind of in general who are like ready to do that work. I think about two things. One, I think that people on the left overestimate the extent to which elections are about policy. If elections were about policy, then Dennis Kucinich would have been the Democratic nominee at some point, and he wasn't. The other thing is that I also think that people on the left undervalue the importance of persuasion. Like, it's not about, we need to do a better job of not trying to win arguments, because like winning arguments isn't about winning. You don't win an argument. We need to do a better job of like informing and persuading people to our points of view. And so my worldview about where the United States is, that we're dismantling the things that made America what we believe in and something worth caring about, is something that like I try to share with people. But like, you're not gonna, it's not like I'm gonna say, hey, Uncle Dennis, Uncle Bob, listen to this podcast with me talking with this guy in California and be on our side. Like, it starts by leaning into kind of casual conversations. I feel like we're living in an era of political polarization, and we're also living in an era where people are retreating into their silos, and we need to not retreat into our silos and kind of lean in and engage in these conversations. And that's how you move people.
Statistics, data doesn't persuade people. It doesn't persuade
nobody.
People. Narratives persuade people.
Exactly.
But that's what makes me feel like now is the time when people should be changing their perspective. Because if George Floyd is nothing else, he is a powerful story. He is the narrative that says you need to rethink the way you see race in America. And for that reason, I have hope that maybe people are beginning to see their own place, their own privilege, white people's own privilege differently. I just don't know if that's where we're headed.
Well, to that point is that like data needs to be couched in stories. And so when I've talked about the coronavirus outbreak in the United States, I've referred to the idea that basically for the last several months, 1,000 people a day, more or less, have been dying. And you can throw that number out there, but like that doesn't mean like somehow that number doesn't wash over people the way it should. And so what I've done is I've compared it to like jumbo jets. Like, think about how big of a deal a plane crash is and how much attention we pay to a plane crash. Like, oh gosh, what airline? Two basically Boeing planes crashed and we grounded every version of that plane, and like airlines have gone out of business over plane crashes. A 747 holds 500 people. And so what we're seeing in the US with the coronavirus is two 747s full of Americans crashing every day. Or what we're seeing during the coronavirus is basically like a 9/11 happening every 4 days. And when you frame it as this is two jumbo jets full of Americans crashing, this is a 9/11 happening every 4 days, I find that resonates more with people than like talking about infection rates or talking about recovery rates. Like, to your point, if you're not, we have to get better at using stories to tell data.
Do you see schools in the United States opening? I know some have opened to already terrible effect. Do you see schools legitimately being open in the US before a vaccine?
Nope. Hold on. Let me modify that. I have a friend who left where I'm from in Tacoma and went to Wyoming and is teaching in, I don't know the name of the town in Wyoming, but like within rural communities, if mass compliance is a thing, then like, yeah. But the idea that like the chancellor of New York City Public Schools is under the impression that they're going to return to school, get out of here with that. No way. No way.
Are you going back to school face-to-face where you are?
We're going back with a hybrid model. And so, okay, so I just said that data doesn't work to convince people, but here's some data really fast. Here in Abu Dhabi, I want to say, I know the number. Across the Emirate, the number is 0.5%. Here in the city, the number is 0.3%. So 0.3% of COVID tests here in the city are coming back positive, 0.5% Emirate-wide. Back in Washington State, where I'm from, the percentage is about 5%. There's two ways to see that data. Way one is that in Washington State and Pierce County, where I'm from, they're only doing about 5% worse than we are here. But the reality is 0.5 to 5 is a factor of 10. The outbreak is 10 times worse in Pierce County than it is here. In Arizona in July, a full 25% of the tests were coming back positive. So if you have a rate of anything above 1% positivity on tests, school, nah, right? But we're in the city down to 0.3%. And so we're going back essentially with a short-term hybrid model, and then we're going to reassess after 3 weeks and after 6 weeks about where we go from there.
Okay. Yeah, I think the WHO even said if you're under 5%, communities can think about reopening, but that seems... I'm not sure I like that situation as a teacher. What are your feelings on remote learning? We went through a big experiment in the spring, and I feel like the narrative, speaking of stories and narratives, I feel like in the US now, the narrative has been remote learning was a failure, full stop. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it, in some cases, it didn't work. In other places, it partially worked, but teachers and schools were dropped into it with zero preparation. So the idea that it would have come off without any problems is ridiculous anyway. What are your thoughts on how it went? If you did remote learning yourself in the spring and just its efficacy going forward?
So we found out that our school was going to close. Well, let's back up. Here, because of calendars and culture, spring break is earlier than it is back home. So I was actually on spring break in Bali, Indonesia, when I found out that school was going to close. Mm. And so we essentially flew back here on a Friday, had a professional development day on Sunday with Islamic calendar. Sunday's a workday for us. And then Monday we were online teaching. And my remote learning experience, I think, went better than a lot of folks around the world and back in the States in particular. My principal, who I hold in very high regard, spent a lot of time like studying what was happening elsewhere. And so whenever we had conversations, she would cite, well, in this school that has been doing this remote learning process since this date, they did this and this didn't work, so we're going to do this instead. And so if you grounded your work in the research, you could do well. But there's an equity aspect to this. Essentially, like, one of the things about working in international school that I think is apparent to you and to me, but the audience may not be, like, might be apparent to them, is that, like, our children who arrive are arriving ready to learn. And they're arriving ready to learn because their basic life needs are met. They have working computers. My school is one-to-one. They have working home internet, and they have safe homes and spaces where they can, like, do their work and studies. Those are the preconditions for remote learning to work. And far too many students in the United States don't have those things. Far too many students don't have working computers. Far too many students don't have working home internet and reliable connections. And for a lot of students in America, like, their school is their refuge from the instability and dysfunction of life. And instead of having their refuge, they're doing the work, which they find unpleasant, in their place where they're not safe. And so if you tell me that remote learning worked at your school, I'm going to tell you that you had infrastructure in place to make remote learning work with technology, and also that your school population basically has their basic life needs met. And if you tell me that remote learning was a clown show, I'm going to tell you that the infrastructure was not in place, technology wasn't in place, and that students' life needs weren't met. And, like, that's it. Like, I'm going to use my hands, which is stupid on a podcast, but here I go. There's an axis of, like, tech readiness and an axis of, like, instructional, like, readiness to learn and student life nonsense. And, like, wherever those points meet, if they meet higher up the tech readiness axis, then, like, kids are ready to learn and remote learning works. And if they meet down here, they're not. So like you need the tech in place and you need kids' lives to be stable and them to have a place to do work. And if those things are in place and you have competent teaching, it should work. Like, here's the funny thing is that Betsy DeVos and all these education reformers in the United States have been yammering on about online learning and remote schooling and like how it's the future. And there was this whole thing about we're moving toward blended learning. And it's really hilarious to me that like the advocates who were caping the loudest for remote learning like 3 years ago when they called it blended learning or called it online learning are the folks saying we have to be back in person the most. Like, again, none of this stuff that's being presented to us stands up to any interrogation. Like the folks who are advocating for in-person schooling the most are the folks who've been saying that our schools are awful and failing kids. And the people who've been advocating for schools and advocating for needs for schools are the folks who are saying that we shouldn't go back. Like here's brass tacks. If you haven't advocated for equitable school funding, and if you haven't advocated for improved outcomes for kids, like and put like that as part of your advocacy, as an adult, then you need to shut the hell up about remote learning one way or the other, because like that's, you are not an advocate for learning. You are an advocate to get your kids out of your life and out of your house because you're bored and tired of your kids. Like that's brass tacks. A lot of folks are just tired of their own kids.
I hear you overlaying, you got Maslow, which you recently were tweeting about, and you're overlaying some tech readiness on that as well as school funding, kind of bringing all these ideas together. So what do you think about schools doing, frankly, what they have to do, running out and buying Chromebooks by the barrel and trying to boost that tech readiness? Do you think that will that help? Will that help? Or as you say, are you just taking the tech and putting it into a student's place of distress, and so ultimately it's maybe for not?
It will help, but it's not the only answer. So there's a debate that needs to be settled. In the year of our Lord 2020, a computer is indispensable in the education of a child. Yeah. And we should no longer view computers as like an option. Like a computer needs to be as like a computer needs to be viewed the same way that a desk and a chair is, as like part of instruction. At the same time, there's an opportunity to make an investment in broadband across the country that needs to be made. Like, here's the really funny thing that's so messed up about this moment in America is that like interest rates are lower than they've ever been, right? Like I was talking to my father-in-law, like when they built their house, their mortgage was, had like a 13% interest rate.
Same right? With my parents. Yep.
Like, Can you even imagine a 13% interest rate? That's insane. Like I'm locked in the fours and looking to refinance. But like that being said, the internet is a public utility that all kids need. If we look at the great crises of American history, typically the great crises produce policy outcomes. The Civil War produces Reconstruction, and we get the amendments to the Constitution 13, 14, 15. The Great Depression produces the New Deal, and we get Social Security, we get welfare programs, we get the jobs programs of the New Deal, like the Works Progress Administration. Arguably, we get the interstate highway system later on after World War II as a result of the Cold War. Out of Watergate, I've mentioned before, we get the Church Commission, we get the creation of the FEC, we get these reforms to our elections. I feel like if we don't come I feel like we're on the verge of coming out of COVID with no policy gains, with no policy remedies to prevent this from happening again. And by the way, I forgot, during the Great Depression, also Glass-Steagall, right? Coming out of this situation, it is apparent to me that the United States of America needs universal nationalized health care, period, full stop. And I don't care if it's a Medicare for all plan. I don't care if it's a Swiss plan. I don't care if it's a Singaporean plan, which leans on health savings accounts. Like, we need universal health care. It can be, call it what you want to, I don't care. We also need universal municipal basic broadband. Everybody should be able to get online with basic broadband. And like, those are the two things that need to come out of this crisis. Like, for sure, we need to invest in epidemiology, invest in the CDC, yada, yada, yada. We need to depoliticize the work of the CDC. But like, the reforms that need to come out of this moment are municipal broadband and universal healthcare. And I don't think that we're any closer to getting either one of those than we were when the crisis started, which to me reinforces the idea that like, we are past our period of being able to do great things.
Yeah, back to your point about the empathy gap. I don't think those of us that live with high-speed broadband, in which companies that are already offering the highest high speeds are looking to make it even faster, are empathizing with rural communities, urban communities that frankly have really bad internet. And
I interviewed somebody like on my podcast about a month ago, and I was talking about the situation with remote learning here. And so back in the States at my old school, my former student teacher took over my job. And so I was talking about how we share resources, and the person who I was interviewing goes, "But when you went to remote learning, things fell apart because Nate, you lived in a developed state." And so she literally referred to the United Arab Emirates as a developed state, with the implication being that the United States is no longer a developed state. And like, there's a Twitter tweet. How old am I? That sounds awful. There's a tweet that I saw that basically said, and I don't like this language. Like, I don't use the term third world because like it's problematic language. Yeah. But like, somebody said that the United States today is a third world state with a Gucci handbag. And like, there's more truth there than I think we realize.
Yeah, I'll tell you, when we drive up to LA from where I am, you have to drive on the 5 in East LA County. And my wife and I say every time we drive, it's embarrassing. I'd be embarrassed if anybody I knew from Oman or anyone I knew overseas came and drove on that segment of highway. They would, this is the United States. This is, you know, as you say, the developed world. It is developed with a Gucci bag. Exactly.
Well, same thing. So whenever I go to Seattle now, what I do is I count homeless tents that I see and I count boats on the water. And the ratio of, I call that like the shame gap. Like, here's the thing is that if you travel abroad, if you travel in, so throughout my travels, I did a lot of travel in Latin America. In every capital in Latin America, there's a green zone that we call it, in San Salvador, in Caracas, in Bogota, that is indispensable from life in the United States, in DF, in Mexico City. But what the deal is that the rest of the people in that country do not have access to the same capital and resources. The US is hurtling toward the same thing, where you're gonna have urbanized cores in which there are wealthy people who live walled off from the masses, and you have just giant inequity gaps or inequality gaps. Like, the people who, and maybe take Caracas out of the conversation, but the wealthy families in Buenos Aires, the wealthiest families in Johannesburg, they live a life that is indistinguishable from the life of middle class and wealthy people in the United States. What we're hurtling towards is that the lower middle class and poor people in the United States, way of life is going to degrade further, where it looks like the poor people elsewhere. Like, we're seeing the United States's lack of economic equality start to resemble inequality in other places. And like, again, is this going to happen? Am I saying that American folks are as bad off as poor folks in Zimbabwe? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. But the average low income person in America is falling behind the wealthier people at an increasing rate. And I don't see a rescue, bailout, change coming down the pipeline unless there's some just fundamental changes in American politics. And it goes beyond like Trump.
All right, last politics question, I think.
Yeah, man.
I hear you channeling some serious Elizabeth Warren. What are your thoughts on Biden's pick of Harris and the ticket?
Honestly, Joe Biden could have picked zombie Richard Nixon in a ham sandwich. And like, I'm still going to vote for Joe Biden, not because I believe in Joe Biden, not because I like Joe Biden. Because here's the thing, in a two-party system with a winner-take-all, elections are binary choices. And so I'm not voting for Joe Biden. I'm not doorbelling for Joe Biden. I'm not excited about Joe Biden. I'm voting against Donald Trump.
And I'll get you out of here on a little comic book talk if we could. So I feel like comic books are the perfect medium for what we're living through right now. I feel like the best comics have just, there's an underlying, I don't know what I'd call it, maybe insanity to all comics, the best comics. There's the right. And I'm curious, is there a comic book for you that is best? It was made for this moment.
So I want to big up that point you made about comic books being made for this moment. Superman is an anti-fascist, right? Captain America is anti-fascist. And anti-fascism is a movement that a lot of people don't understand that I subscribe to, but that's a different conversation. A couple of books like resonate with me in this moment. So most of my comic book reading happens either in the Batman universe or in the X-Men universe. And I think a lot about there's two arcs I think about. One, I think about the techno-organic virus. So this is the virus that was created by Strife. For the uninitiated, you may know the character Cable. Cable is the descendant of Cyclops and Jean Grey, who was sent back from the future. He's infected with a techno-organic virus, which basically has replaced his arm with cybernetics. That virus was created by Strife, and Strife is the clone of Cable created by Apocalypse. Who got that right? All right. There's a whole arc essentially where there's a viral weapon that is sent back into the past, and or the past being our present. And the way in which the community in the Marvel Universe responded to the virus at that point is the exact same way in which we are responding to the virus in many ways. It's hostility towards mutants, and mutants are often a proxy for Black people in the X-Men books. And it's also hostility towards immigrants in those books. And essentially what happens is the result of that book in that arc is a massive reactionary rightward swing in the imaginary America. And I'm going to argue that that story arc is a compression of the last 4 years of American politics. We have a reactionary rightward swing and a pandemic that's going about. The other book that it makes me think about is, I always get this right, or I always get this wrong, sorry. Is it Days of Future Past or Days of Future Present when Bishop gets sent back in time?
Okay.
Whichever one it is, if I took you, dear listener, and I sent you back in time to the year 1995, and I said to you, the United States government in 2020 is going to be at war in Afghanistan for its 19th year. Donald J. Trump is going to be the president. There's going to be a viral epidemic that will kill 1,000 people a day, and that the majority, if not nearly all countries in the world, will have closed their borders to Americans. You would have told me that you were living, that's post-apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
We live in that dystopia. And so, that's the work ahead. If I would have told you 25, 30 years ago that was our future, you would have called it a dystopia, and that's where we are now. So what do we need to do? And the hero of that arc is Bishop, and Bishop was the first Black X-Men that I glommed onto. And what I love about Bishop is that Bishop's power is to basically to receive kinetic energy and then to redirect it. And honestly, that is what it's like to be Black in America right now. So much negative energy comes your way, and you have to just kind of redirect it into positive things.
That creeping dystopia, I think, I know on your podcast recently, you talked about How Democracies Die, great book, and it talks a bit about that. I'll just quickly put a plug in for a great short series called Black Hammer by my favorite author, Jeff Lemire. He's amazing, but Black Hammer, the cadre of superheroes after defeating their nemesis Anti-God are basically stranded in what they're not sure what it is, but it appears to be some kind of a parallel universe. Looks like small town America. They can't leave, and they're there for 10 years. And so the book delves a lot into just the mental health effects of this quarantine. They can't leave at Groundhog Day, right? Day after day. And to me, I think that's that captures a lot of what we've gone through. Well, Nate Bowling, there are podcast episodes in which the best thing the host can do is just stay out of his own way. And that was today for sure. I really appreciate you coming on, and thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
A big thanks to Nate for his insights. Lots of inspiring stuff there, perhaps none more so than when he said, "I don't teach pessimism, I teach activism." We have an incredible chance in this new school year to have hard conversations about issues that could inspire negativity, pessimism, and cynicism in our students. It's our job to lift those conversations up and show students that they can most certainly be part of the solution. through their own local actions. Thanks for checking out What's the Big Idea. As always, we welcome comments and questions on Twitter at Big Idea Ed. Music today from Solove, courtesy of Creative Commons and Tribe of Noise. Stay safe out there, everyone, and I wish you all the best of luck as the new school year begins.
Used to say, one day I'm gonna rule the world, and you'll tell your friends I knew that girl. She loved me once, but I let her get away. That's what I swore you'd say. These days I don't walk, I fly, and you see the shape of my body as I soar through the sky. Used to shine so bright, but all colors fade.